Hello, heroes. Today's episode is brought to you by Hearts Blazing, the card-based story game of episodic, dramatic, romantic, action-packed science fiction from Games by Playdate, now on Kickstarter. Go check it out! Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I have a very special announcement for you. Not only will I be at Gen Con 2016, I have just been selected to be a Gen Con Industry Insider featured presenter. So if you're making it to Indy this year, you may get to hear me talking about role-playing and podcasting and probably lots of other things with the other featured presenters. And trust me, I am in some very good company. It's a huge honor, and I'm pretty excited about the opportunity to share what I can about those aspects of role-playing that are meaningful to me. Speaking of Gen Con, you will also find me at the One Shot Network annual panel, which is on Saturday night at 6. We're all going to go out for drinks afterwards, so you should totally be there. And have I mentioned that I was asked to be a professor at New World Magiscola? Speaking of honors, I will be teaching divination on the fourth weekend, and there are still some tickets left. So, if you want to go to wizard school, I could be your wizard teacher, and it would be really fun. Anyway, today's show, I have freeform designer Sarah Williamson on to talk about games that build connections, games that make you feel something, and games that ground you in the experience of being human. Also, Muppets. Let's get right to it. Ah, Sarah, yay! I'm very excited to have you on the show. I feel like we could talk about some really fun stuff.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yay. So Sarah, freeform designer out of New York City, I want to ask you about the term freeform as like a descriptor of games. Mm-hmm. What about the word freeform helps you design or helps you play?
So I think that one of the things that I like about freeform is that it is pretty poorly defined, actually. So it's one of these terms that has kind of sprung up in order to describe a type of game that doesn't always fit neatly into categories. And so I think my favorite thing about saying that I design freeform games is that it almost always prompts a follow-up question of like, what's a freeform game? And then I get to talk a little bit about different games and the games that I make. And so it's not something that fits neatly into any sort of category.
Cool. I like that. Sometimes when I talk about games, a lot of people go like, oh, video games? And then you end up having to describe things in the negative, which is like not the most fun conversation, right?
Yeah, I usually try to describe games as like sort of analog and about getting people together in a room. And sometimes you're at a table and sometimes you're up and standing around. And so that sort of explains the sort of not digital component. But yeah, it is. I try to also avoid describing things in the negative, and so that way you're not sort of like, oh, I'm a game designer, but I'm not the game designer you're probably thinking of. That kind of like sounds a little sad, but I love being an analog game designer, so I want to come out and be like really positive about that.
That's cool. Do you find that you have a lot of opportunity? Because I love talking about games with people who don't consider themselves gamers. Is that something you have a lot of opportunity to do?
It is, and it's kind of funny because sometimes it feels like I can't avoid talking about it, usually because, you know, I feel like I usually have, like, some sort of project going on, and so I'll be like, oh, I have a deadline I'm working on for this hobby, and then I'll like, sort of start there, and it can be, like, a really interesting way to talk about something that the person you're talking to probably has, like, no experience with. And that's kind of fun and interesting, trying to describe something to people that don't have a lot of reference points. Although, also a lot of times people will start out thinking that they have no reference points, and they're like, wait a minute, you like get together with your friends and you play out a tragic relationship breakup for fun and you call it a game? And I'm like, yeah. And then they'll be like, I have no idea what that's like. And I was having one of those conversations with someone recently, and probably like 30 minutes into it, he was like, oh, wait, I do have something that's kind of like this. I was a Civil War reenactor for several years. And I was like, oh, so you know all about LARPing. You just call it something else. And then there we had like this really, really great conversation.
That's super rad. Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with like my uncle's friend, this like, you know, late 50s dude. And like at first he had no idea what he was talking about. And then he started telling me about his wife's like meetup group where like a bunch of retired women get together and play charades. And he was talking about how much fun they had. And I was like, that's the dopest thing on earth.
Yeah, and that's what I love about freeform too, because I feel like I could just pull something in like that, and like that could totally be like the seed to a really great freeform game, like just building on top of someone's like meetup where they play charades. I think that's a really big thing that I'm into right now, is trying to figure out how to get people who aren't traditionally gamers into playing these sorts of games, making them more accessible to people.
And what is like, what's the strategy there for you in terms of making games more accessible?
I think it's like trying to figure out where I have connections to new audience. I'm really fortunate in that I live in a city where there are so many weird things going on. And so I have all these connections to, it's like, oh, I like tangentially know folks who are really into these like weird art parties. And I have friends who are super into the theater scene and know a lot of actors. And I have friends who are more into like the indie digital games communities. And so I think just trying to figure out how to run events for those folks and like kind of bring them into the fold, that's like one of my goals for the coming year.
And I guess that's an advantage of talking about games in this kind of loosey-goosey freeform way, is that people don't get tripped up. You know, they don't have this idea that like, oh, that's not for me. If they don't know what it is at all, then they don't know if it's for them or not.
Yeah, there was a really wonderful theater game sort of event called The Universe is a Small Hat that ran here in New York at Baby Castles, which is a exhibition space and really great like game community center that sort of crossed that bridge between interactive theater and a LARP sort of game. Lizzie Stark consulted on it. And I really hope that there's like more things that spring up mm-hmm. that are like that.
When you see stuff like Sleep No More and things like that, or even escape rooms or whatever, which I'm sure there's more of in New York than you could count, like, do you see that as like promising, as like, oh, a step on the way to, you know, freeform and role playing?
I really do, because I think it shows that there's this audience that's interested in these sorts of experiences. And I think that it's just a trick of like, how do you package something and make it accessible to people that they can show up with no preparation and get brought into something. You know, an escape room does a really good job of taking people who have never done it before and only have like the barest understanding of like the pitch and introducing them to the rules of the game. And I think that that's something where when I sit down to make a game, I'm really trying to think hard about like, okay, how much like introduction does someone really need? And how do you like warm someone up gradually to the idea of it so they don't have to come prepared, like knowing a lot of things or having a lot of common cultural reference points? And how can they have this experience and feel like they're an equal participant to it and feel like they're not at a disadvantage, maybe if they're playing with people who they've been to a million of these things?
Are there a lot of other people, are there other people doing what you do in your local area? And do you, and totally separate question, I think, do you feel like you're part of a community of design?
I do. I'm really lucky to have an amazing group of people. And it's sort of like a side community that's like sprung up around folks who go to the Metatopia and Dreamation events and go to other sorts of things. And I'm lucky to have a lot of friends that I can just sit down and talk to about game design. And some of them I've collaborated with, and the rest of them I haven't had a chance to collaborate with yet, but I hope to soon.
Yeah, collaboration is like kind of your thing, right? I'm thinking of the handful of games I want to ask you about, and they were all made with other folks. What's the advantage or what's the fun of making games with someone else versus making them on your own?
I think that the process is just so much more enjoyable, and it's also so much easier to just sort of get through a project when you have the social reward of like, I'm going to sit down and do this with a person, and especially someone that is a friend or that you feel close to. I mean, there are certainly some challenges to it, especially if like you have really different ideas about a component of the game and like how you resolve that. But I feel like the benefits like so far outweigh those sorts of things. And I'm really happy with all of the projects that I've gotten to work on collaboratively lately.
Yay. Yeah. Another thing I find interesting about your games is that they very rarely take the form of like a commercial product. And I think there's often like an unspoken assumption that a game sort of has to or should. What are the advantages of just not operating in that mode?
So I think it really depends. And it's an interesting question of like, how do you actually get your audience to engage with what you're putting out there? So I've had two games so far that have gone into Festival, which is the Danish freeform convention. And so they define freeform in kind of an interesting way where it's like a little bit more tabletop-y than what we usually mean when we use that term. And the first one was 183 days, which is a game about two clairvoyants, the only two clairvoyants in the world, and they fall in love with each other and that relationship. And then the most recent one that went to festival is called See Me Now, and it's a game about gender in sort of different situations as a group of friends age. And the really nice thing about festival is that they've got this great tradition of releasing all of the scenarios on the Alexandria Library, where you can go and download like this wonderful wealth of scenarios. They have a lot that are in English, and so it's this really great source of people who are new to LARP and new to freeform and new to especially Nordic games, and they want to play and download those. So getting the chance to sort of like put scenarios up there, I think we definitely want to upload See Me Now when we get there. I think the biggest challenge, though, to not sort of having a game as a commercial product is that it can also limit the form that your game takes. So one of the really nice things that I like about 183 Days is that we were able to design it so that it's a deck of cards and it's kind of perfectly contained in that deck of cards. But you can't really give away a deck of cards in the same way that you can give away a PDF. So I think that there are different sort of like advantages and disadvantages to each. I definitely am a little glad that I've so far avoided a giant Kickstarter project, only really because like those are just a little intimidating to me. But one way that we also decided to handle 183 days was to just donate the proceeds to charity, so we're not really involved in the business of selling games. And that's something that personally I like.
And not because like there's anything wrong with that business, but like I think it's comparatively boring compared to like making games.
Yeah, I think I just like I'm way more interested in games as a form of creative expression and a hobby for me than I am as trying to sort of like make an income from them. There are so many designers who I really love and respect who do make a living from their games, at least partially, and I think that that's really rad. I definitely think that art and creative expression should be sustainable for the creators when possible, but there's such a drawback sometimes in like the accounting overhead, so I'm pretty happy whenever I can find a solution that gets my games into the hands of people but leaves me out of that sort of business side of things a little bit.
Do you think that that has an influence on what you're able to do or what you come up with or what you're able to make just because you don't have to be thinking about that side of it?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the really nice thing about freeform is that, and sort of LARP scenarios too, is that since there is such a tradition of releasing them for free and just sort of sharing them with the wider internet, there isn't enough of a market that I have any sense of like what the market wants and that doesn't therefore influence me at all. So I really get to make the game that I want to make, which I think is actually true for like most of the indie game design world. It's pretty nice that we're in a position where being able to follow your creative vision is a really strong factor, I think, in like most people's design.
Okay, I want to ask you about Group Date, which is like a short freeform scenario about a couple's first three dates, basically. Yeah, I nailed it, right? That's the pitch?
Yeah.
It won Most Convention Ready in the 2014 Golden Cobras, which is awesome. And it's described as a cross between a Charlie Kaufman film and a Virginia Woolf novel via the Muppets. Now, I must ask, were any of those conscious influences?
Only the Muppets, I have to. There was this really funny article. It was published on Slate, like, several years ago that kind of stuck in my head about Order Muppets and Chaos Muppets, and the idea that you can sort of divide all of the Muppets and therefore, of course, all humans in this like sort of tongue-in-cheek fashion into these two categories. And so in Group Date, you play out these two people going on their first three dates, but you play it out by a group of people each representing the person. And so one of the people that a group of you is representing is more of an order person and the other is more of a chaos person. And I find that there's something kind of simple and universal enough there in those descriptors that it's pretty easy for people to relate to them. And I think that's part of what makes Group Date like a really good game for people who are new to freeform or new to LARPing or just new to any of these sorts of games or experiences. It seems to be, I've run it a few times for people who this is their first sort of thing, and they seem to like be able to get into it pretty easily.
There's something relatable and kind of universal about that kind of personality thing, right? Because it's phrased as like a personality quiz, and then you get your very scientific answer and sort yourselves based on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like not so thinly an allusion to like dating sites like OkCupid, where you like go and you answer all of these questions, and then you get, you know, sorted into these groups, basically, where if I wanted to, I could go on that website and only look at people who are a 99% match to me. and just sort of that idea that you can sort people. It's like, it's meant to be a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's also something that a lot of people, especially nowadays, have experiences with.
Yeah, and can respond to, right? So other than the Muppets, what would you say are influences on your design?
Oh, wow. So 183 Days is an direct influence, is a really wonderful novella called 6 Months, 3 Days by Charlie Jane Anders. So we took that short story as an inspiration and based the characters in the game sort of loosely on the characters in that story. And I had a really wonderful chance to actually like sit down and show the game to Charlie Jane when we met up at a convention last year.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was really wonderful and kind of like blew me away that I got to actually like go up to the author that made this wonderful thing and be like, I made this thing. I hope that you like it. So that was really cool. And I think other influences, I also wrote a game for the indie mixtape collection that was inspired by the song Shelter by the XX. And the indie mixtape collection is this really wonderful anthology of games that are all inspired by songs. And so Jason Morningstar has a game in there called Darlin' Corey, which is about this like really wonderful, intense folk song. And there are all sorts of really, really good, short, accessible games in there. Other than that, I would say that I draw a lot on my own experiences. See Me Now is probably one of the most personal games I've written so far, mm-hmm. in that there are elements of my actual life, like pretty deeply embedded in that game, in the scene cards.
Yeah, so See Me Now is a scenario. You sort of have these cards that are like little life events, and you all play characters. It's very Nordic, you know, you all sort of have characters, but you like jump in and out and play different people. Mm-hmm. And they all have to do with gender. And they're all these just weird little ways, or gender and sexuality, I guess, and weird little ways that you kind of like bump into these things as kids and as teenagers. And a lot of that game just feels really real, like too real, like extremely real.
I guess that's good. I mean, that was pretty much one of our design goals.
Was it, I know your co-designer, Liz Gorinsky, was at Fastival. Was it well received? Did you hear anything back from how that went?
Yeah, I actually just recently read Mo Holkar just wrote a blog post about people playing See Me Now and a group of people that they ran over the convention slot by like some amount of time because the players are all so insistent that they like have a few more scenes for their characters. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like it definitely resonated with a couple people there. And that's always something I'm really happy to hear about.
What is it satisfying in a different way? I mean, some of your games are like adaptations and some of them are very fanciful, but is there a particular satisfaction to making like a semi-autobiographical game or one that is that personal?
There is. In particular, there's one scene in See Me Now. So the way that we sat down to sort of write these cards, and the cards all just like correspond to different life events, and the players get to pick them in any order. So you could jump around from like starting from an adult scene and then go backwards into your childhood, or, you know, progress from childhood to your teenage years to sort of being an adult. But one of the scenes that I put in is just this like really funny memory that's like stuck with me for a very long time of going to preschool on the first day and wanting to play with the dinosaur toys. And there were a group of boys playing with the dinosaur toys, and I like walked over to them and I was like, "Hey, I want to play with you." And they looked like they were having a lot of fun, and they just flat out said, like, "No, you're a girl. You cannot do this with us." And so I kind of, like, snatched a T-Rex out of their hands and, like, hit them with it, which is not exactly, like, great preschool behavior.
Backstory does not endorse hitting people with plastic dinosaurs, even if it is cool.
Yeah, and so it was just, like, when you're a kid, gender can be so black and white. Mm. And especially like that experience was, I mean, it's like first day of preschool. That's exactly when you are going from your home where you have like one set of beliefs and sort of standards of behavior and things, ways that you act and ways that you talk to other humans. And you're a tiny little human and you're thrown into this environment with other humans. And I was confronted with like some pretty like silly but still ugly like attitudes about what toys little girls can play with. And so I knew when I sat down to write this game, I wanted that scene to go in there because the prompt that we used when writing scene cards was like, just think of a time in your life when gender mattered. Like it could be in a good way or it could be in a bad way or a neutral way, just any sort of time where this felt like a really salient detail of your life. And so getting to put that in the game and then see other people just like go off of that prompt and play that, I got to see a lot of people actually like rehabilitate that scene. And it was like a really sweet and wonderful version of that scene because we didn't want to put our hands on the scales too much of like making things oppressive in any way. We wanted to like leave it very open to things going positively. And so seeing a group of adults who were my friends playing children and play that interaction out in a way that actually like was affirming was really, really cool and satisfying as a designer.
Yeah, that sounds like kind of magical, actually. And it's a game that like really allows you to, or I think encourages you to play people of like all different, or, sorry, characters of like all different genders and different gender expressions. But it's not necessarily like a game about trans people or a game about cis people. Like I feel like everyone has had some experiences in their life where they're like, where yeah, gender just kind of shows up and you're like, really?
Yeah, actually, definitely wanted to make sure that there were scenes and cards and sort of prompts that brought trans lives into focus and into reality, because I think if we wrote a game about gender, but we only sort of made it about our own experiences or about things that kind of immediately come to mind, it could have the capacity to like potentially erase trans experiences. And I say that even as someone who is cisgender but has like some level of gender dysphoria. Like a lot of people I know, like there are moments where I'm like, oh, this just doesn't fit. I like want to like if it were an outfit that I could just like take off and put on a different one day to day, then I totally would. So there are some scenes in there that are like very centered on trans expressions of gender, particularly in the kind of things that deal with transition, but we definitely wanted to make sure that it was accessible to people that either have those experiences or haven't ever had those experiences or known anyone who had those experiences. And I was really like personally satisfied when I played it with a cis guy that I know who was just like, oh, this was a really good venue for me to like reflect on masculinity and the way that it's operated in my life. I think that masculinity is one of those like insufficiently explored topics. There's another really interesting game that I haven't actually ever played, but I've read, but it's like a little popular called The Clay That Woke, that's like all about masculinity.
Pulse-out game, yeah.
I'm like completely fascinated by it, and I am very much value that like there is this tabletop game about minotaurs in the jungle, and it's also very, very much about masculinity.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one too, because it takes, I think, some of the iconography of like a sort of like pulpy adventure, like fantasy stuff, and like totally embraces that, but at the same time is asking like really like genuinely interesting and kind of provocative questions.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. I hope I'll get the chance to play
We should play it next time we hang out, because I haven't played it
We
either.
totally should. Yeah, I think the big barrier so far, and this feels so silly, is that you have to like print and cut out a bunch of tokens and just like
I know.
every.
Speaking of games as a commercial product, like,
I know, if only I had backed the Kickstarter, the token level, I definitely would have played it already.
There you go, listeners. If you think you're gonna like a game, go all out. Get the hardcover. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier a game called Shelter, which I had an opportunity to play recently.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it
Not many
was
people have played it.
that you know of. How would you
Yeah,
know,
that I
right?
know of. I mean, that's true. I guess it's like I only know the people who've let me know.
And it's an intimate game, and I don't know if they necessarily would have like I'm not posting a play report anytime soon. That is a very intimate game, Sarah, now that I have you in front of me.
Yeah.
Did you, as a designer, intend for your players to have sex about two-thirds of the way through?
I wouldn't say that it was an intention, but it was definitely an option. I think that I wrote that game at a point in my life when my design projects and my romantic life were like very much intertwined. And I wanted a game that could kind of scale with the level of physicality that you were interested in having with your play partner. I say play partner in like multiple senses of it's an interesting one. It's also the first game that I ever wrote, so this is the first time that I was really like putting words to paper and saying like, okay, here is me trying to like make a game, because I felt like there wasn't a game that existed that did the thing that I wanted. And I left it very open-ended. I said, like, you know, one of the mechanics here is touch. And I like give a couple examples of how you might use touch to convey emotion, like longing. But I, you know, didn't get super specific into how one might do that. And kind of, I had it in my head that like it could be played while someone was having sex. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to make sure that it would like scale well. And I also really wanted to make sure that like a really good consent negotiation and sort of like happened up front.
Definitely. And that's in the design, right? To say like you decide up front, and there's I think the game gives you a lot of credit in terms of your ability as like an adult to have a discussion between the two of you about like, and you mentioned like enthusiastic consent. So however both of you are really enthusiastic about touching each other, that's how far you go and like no farther, right? I think in analog games, despite the fact that like half the advantage is that we are these like real human beings actually interacting with each other face to face, I think there's a lot of like fear of touch. And it's so beautiful to see a game that's kind of, that sees it as like a possibility and like an advantage and like, wow, this is something we could do something really cool with. I mean, what do you think the possibilities of touch are in role-playing?
Oh, it's like this intensely powerful tool that we have at our disposal. I mean, when you think about like the direction that a lot of digital games are going in, especially with like VR, you know, it's sort of like, how do you create this like super immersive experience? And it's like, well, analog games, like we are totally there and we have the ability to form like a real connection between people. When we were writing 183 Days, an article came out in the New York Times about like an experiment that a psychologist had tried about how to sort of get people to fall in love. I think the title of the article is "To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This." And it's about answering a series of sort of escalating questions and then having eye contact in order to form a bond. And so we decided to use that in the game, not as intimate as those questions get. So it's not quite, the goal wasn't to like actually get people to fall in love or to like do any sort of psychological trick on them, but just to sort of like gradually increase the amount of emotional intimacy that you're having with your co-player. And then it's a little bit of a spoiler, but there is like a period of sustained eye contact in that game, which I think is like this really funny, weird experience of just the idea that you would like sit across a table or sit on a couch with somebody and actually like stare into their eyes for a long time. That's something that doesn't feel unsafe to me, and I think it doesn't feel unsafe to a lot of people, which is why I wanted to use it. But it is very intimate, and it can break down a lot of barriers, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And eye contact is in some ways like has the potential to be a lot more intimate than contact, or like more intimidating, or more, I don't know, it feels like the stakes are really high when you make that kind of prolonged eye contact with someone. I don't know why.
Yeah, and I think there's so much power in our gaze, you know, like I think opening a game with something like that to me was a way to ground the players in their bodies a little bit and get them to really be aware of one another. Like I found I actually got to demo that game at an event at the NYU Game Center. And so I was like sitting down with strangers and doing basically like the first 15 minutes of the game with every one of them. Wow. Kind of over and over again. So it was like answering emotional questions and then looking into each other's eyes. And I found that it's very difficult to not appreciate the beauty in someone's face when you're doing that exercise. Like you will definitely find things in the other person that you can admire. And that's a really powerful experience, I think, just like getting people to take the time out of whatever is going on in their heads and like focus on another human being for a little bit. I found that to be like a really cool and wonderful thing, even with strangers. I mean, it's not necessarily a game that I would recommend for everybody to play with a stranger, but I found it to be a really rewarding experience. the biggest source of power that we have are the connections that the players have with each other and the connections you can make with other people through this activity. I mean, I've made so many deep and lasting friendships through games, and especially games about relationships and games that get to these sort of like core human experiences. To me, that's like the ultimate design goal that I can be aspiring towards.
Oh, I just like that. I just like that so much. What are other design goals that you have? I mean, I think like building connections and bridges between people and allowing them to, or be more connected than they are. What else are you thinking about when you're making a game that other people will play?
I think right now I'm actually like trying to figure out how to get things that I am super fascinated by sort of in like my other weird hobbies, like how do I shoehorn those into games just for like the crazy fun of it. I have been working on a game sort of in my head or in like scraps of paper, like I'll like write down like a couple scribbled notes on a receipt about insects because I just I love insects so much. And I really want a game that kind of like gets people to be embodied in an alien form. There's a really wonderful Twine game by Porpentine called With Those We Love Left Alive. And it's a game where you know, it's Twine, so you're clicking through these different bits of text in order to get the story as it unfolds. And as the story unfolds, you write sigils on your body that correspond to different things going on. And I love all of that so much. I love the embodiment. I love the story. I also love that there are like amazing alien insect creatures like all throughout it. And so I really want to find a game that now that I've like tried to make a lot of games that kind of ground you in the experience of being a human and relate to your body and relate to the other humans around you, I kind of want to like go directly at something that most people find really alien and other and figure out how to replicate what I imagine that experience to be.
Yeah, ground people in their bodies or something else's body.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who thinks that Twine and analog role-playing have a lot to say to each other.
Yeah, definitely. And there's so much really, really exciting work going on there. I think that's one of the other really wonderful things about New York is that I get to go to cool events where like Twine designers show up. And I got to take a Twine class from Kara Ellison.
Oh, awesome.
A few years ago, and that was pretty amazing. So I think that's also a form that I want to explore at some point. It has so much potential, and also it's going back to the question of audience and sort of like how you expand your reach. Like, there's definitely this huge audience out there for these weird Twine games. I feel like going in that direction is like a really cool thing that analog game designers could be doing more of.
I think what Twine and like analog games have in common is that you have to rely on text more than visuals. Mm-hmm. Like, not that some of both of those games don't employ visuals, but like very often it's about like sort of painting an image and then letting the person's imagination take over. And like, that's where analog games really shine. And even, you know, in Shelter, you're not just touching each other. You're using that as a way to express like a setting and a theme. Right, or like an emotion, kind of. I completely forget where I was going with this. I'm just so excited about things happening in games. Have you made a Twine game?
I've made a Twine game. I haven't released a Twine game. I made a Twine game just for my girlfriend. She throws a party every single year called Goth Luau. And so I made a Goth Luau Twine game to sort of like celebrate that. But I have not like kind of put it out there on the internet. It's like on my agenda perhaps to like actually release work.
But I to do.
Yeah, but for that class, like we were talking about making vignette games and just sort of like capturing the experience of a particular event or moment. Twine is such a great form for that because you can just cram detail into everything and let people click to unfold. Whereas if you're writing like a short story, you know, you might worry about like, oh, am I like bogging down the reader like too much in this paragraph with all of these like sensory descriptions? But in Twine, you can like let them unfold gradually by letting the player like click around. And so that's like something that the medium has really embraced.
Yeah, I think we should make a video game together, Sarah. I'm just deciding in this moment. I haven't made a Twine game in many years, and I think we should. big plans in this episode of Backstory. So if not that, or maybe that, what's like next? What other sort of gaming projects do you have in the work, if any?
I think there are a few different things. There's focusing a little bit more on the community organizing aspect of things, of trying to run events. I have a Facebook group that I maintain called Freeform NYC. It's a little bit on hiatus right now because I got a new job and that has like kind of overwhelmed my life for a little bit, but ramping that back up and trying to make events that are actually open to the public is a goal of mine. Also, so my roommate and dear friend and the person who I wrote 183 Days with, James Stewart, we've been kicking around the idea of doing a game jam about games from your terrible dreams, mostly as a way so that like people could tell their terrible dream stories without actually having that guilt and that like horribleness of like, oh, now I have to tell you the story, but like actually just giving everyone permission to take their dreams that they're like rattling around in their head and write a crazy weird game around them. I have like several drafts of my own dreams that I've turned into games. Some of them involve yelling at fire, where like fire is played by other people. Mm-hmm. So those are things that you may see out of me sometime this year. We will see. I think we're just trying to figure out on like a really good name for this game jam.
Oh yeah, it's got to be Choice.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that will like happen. There are so many other wonderful game jams that happen though. So like figuring out when to launch your game jam is like a really tough thing.
Yeah, true say. Well, I mean, I feel like I talk about the Golden Cobras every single episode of this show, but I feel like it's generated a lot of really cool stuff. And I know you've participated. What is like the fun or what is the appeal of, because you know, you could just make a game whenever you want. What's the appeal of operating in like a contest or jam or whatever?
I think it has to be really tied to the specific context and sort of like what's going to come out of it. I think that the thing that I really love about Golden Cobra is that the winning games get run at Metatopia. That's, to me, that's such a huge reward. And it's kind of like the best reward that you could ever offer somebody who's a game designer, like saying like, oh, I'm actually going to run your game for people and make sure people play it and tell you how it went. Like, I think that's like the best prize you could offer anybody. And it's an extremely generous prize, I think, for the organizers to offer. Another really rewarding thing for me about Golden Cobra is that there's a really great mentor system set up. And I've gotten to participate as a mentor to new game designers both years that it's run. And I think that that's, it's been really rewarding for me. And it's, you know, from what I've heard, it's been really rewarding for the different people who have taken advantage of it and getting that mentorship. And I think like putting game designers in dialogue with one another is a really wonderful, powerful thing that can come out of like when you design a game around a contest or a game jam or like some sort of organized event. That's like a great advantage that especially new designers, it also is a really great way for new designers to sort of give themselves permission. I know that I had thought about making a game for a long time before the indie mixtape anthology idea came about. And that was sort of like what pushed me over the edge, was this idea that like, okay, there's a game anthology, it's raising money for charity. I can write a game on this like really easy prompt of just like think of a song that's resonated with you and make a game based on it and send it out into the world. And that was a really great opportunity to not worry about like, oh, do I have whatever cred that I need to be a game designer? Like, no, actually this is for everybody. Just go for it, do it. And so I think that running events like that, even though they're, I love that there are so many of them because it means that like whichever one someone grabs onto and like it resonates with them, they can just take part in it. And there are so many like choices out there.
There's something about the like really like low key, low pressure approach to offering someone a game when it's part of a mixtape or part of an anthology or part of just like, here's a bunch of games and like, no press. If you think mine's cool, then you can play it. No big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like another really impressive, wonderful anthology that I want to plug is the hashtag feminism anthology, which was another set of games that was at Fastball this last year. I didn't get a chance to participate in it since I was pretty busy with See Me Now, since it was like the same set of deadlines, but it's a really, really amazing collection of games, and everyone involved just like did an excellent job as collaborators, putting this thing together. If anyone listening has not seen this yet, please go check it out. It's amazing. It looks like a glossy magazine. The formatting is absolutely beautiful. There's like this whole assortment of games. And it clearly says like how many players, the level of emotional intensity, which I love. I kind of feel like all games now need like an emotional intensity rating.
Oh my goodness. Yes. And what's the system? It's like it's tiers or something. It's like something out of five tiers.
Teardrops or droplets of blood. I think it's like a little ambiguous. When I saw it, I definitely saw droplets of blood. I think most human beings probably see tears, but I think either works. I mean, because we have, by way of Emily Carr-Boss, this really great term, bleed, for sort of not emotional intensity necessarily, but like the spillover between your emotions as a player into your character's emotions or your character's emotions back into you as a player. So I kind of like go in that direction sometimes.
Yeah. Do you think your games are bleedy, or are you designing for bleed?
I think it, with some games I am. With 183 Days, I definitely was explicitly designing for bleed.
Yeah.
I would say like, since it opens by having the players talk about their own real experiences first, that's a warm up and a technique that was kind of explicitly designed to connect the player's actual experience with the game and with their co-player. Also because it's like something that can work really well when you're trying to design a game that's a little more light in terms of either like rules or mechanics or text that you're putting out there. With 183 Days, you know, we had the challenge of like trying to get 2 hours of a game onto all these cards. And some of the scenes, like they have a very sparse, you know, sort of prompt. Like there isn't a lot there that the game is giving you. In every case, it kind of like is trusting the players to fill in all those narrative gaps. And it says early on, you know, like you can use your experiences as material. The very first scene of the game is a first date scene. And I kind of think that many people have been on first dates or seen them represented in media. And so to me, like designing for bleed can also really go hand in hand in designing for something that's accessible, because you're allowing people to blend their real lived experience with the game that you made.
Just based on like the feedback that you've heard from 183 Days, does everyone end that game just going like, oh my God, this game is about us? Because that was totally my experience of playing with it. I was like, why did they make this game about us? How did they save our souls? And like just convincing myself that like, no, I'm sure everyone who plays this must just be like, no, everyone thinks it's about us. I don't know. Back me up here, maybe?
You know, I think that there's so much in there that really is universal. I mean, one of the harshest sort of things in there for me is like, what's it like to be in a relationship when at least one of you is pretty sure that it's not going to work out?
Yeah.
And how do you navigate that? And I mean, that's a really common experience, I think. Also, because you're bringing so much of yourself into the game when you play, like it kind of has to be about you and whoever you're playing it with, I think. I've had some really powerful experiences with the game, and I've heard about people having really powerful experiences with the game. Some seem like to play closer to home than others. I mean, a different type of powerful experience that I heard when the game ran at Fastival, I got to hear from someone who was a man, and he said, like, you know, most of my life I've been pretty sure that I'm straight. Like, there are moments, you know, mm-hmm. and lots of people have. But this game made me really experience, for at least a couple hours, like, love for this man that I was playing with. And that's never something I thought I would get to experience.
Wow.
And so that to me is like, okay, the game wasn't really about them, like those two people, because, you know, that was outside of their regular lives in such a profound way, right? Where mm-hmm. like it deviated from the way they normally relate to one another. But there was still something like real and powerful and intense there for them.
Yeah, no, let me go way too personal on the podcast here, but like I had a super intense experience of play. Like at the end, we were like, I was like almost in tears. We were like apologizing to each other about all these things. Like, yeah, it was like, oof, but in a good way. I don't know, because we often think of like emotional intensity as like, that must mean that it's negative and you're sad. Like emotional intensity can also be like joy and laughter and like.
Yeah. I think that like, if you don't ever have that, than if you like shy away from that emotional intensity. I mean, you can, like, not all people are me. I shouldn't like generalize my preferences and desires. Like, my preferences and desires are very clearly for like, go out and experience as much of this like intensity as you can. Mm-hmm. To me, I think it's like practice, right? Like playing out a tragic relationship ending in a LARP is like a perfect way for me to relate to like my actual experience and feel those feelings and like learn to deal with them. Like real lives are hard and real lives are intense. And to me, exploring those topics in play is like a really excellent way of engaging with these things rather than avoiding them.
Yeah, dealing with instead of just like running away or turning away. Can you design for joy, or can you design for like intensity? Like, is that a possible thing, or will it all just come off as like, I don't know, tear jerky or too easy or whatever?
I mean, that's definitely like the reputation I think that a lot of these games have, is that they're real sad and tear jerky and all that stuff. And that's not undeserved, right? Mm-hmm. Like I said, my preferences are very strongly in that direction, but that's not for everybody. Like, you know, my reaction to like my real life being intense is to like go towards that, but other people's like totally legit reactions to their own lives being intense is like, ooh, I want my play and my leisure time to be like lighthearted and fun. And actually I think like group date, I really tried to be lighthearted and fun when I run it. I think that it can go in a more intense direction, but it's meant to be kind of like a zany, fun, like funny dating sort of experience. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think that's something that a designer has like some control over. It also really depends on like who's running the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, to some extent, like you make this thing and you like put a lot of thought into it, or, you know, in some cases like me, if I'm under a deadline, I like throw it together and send it out into the world. And then it's kind of up to the people playing and the people running and seeing like what they bring to the table. I think like there are a lot of different ways that these games can go. And I think that's an advantage. Like it means that there's flexibility there. Mm.
Is it hard to let go of outcomes? Like as a designer, do you get attached to how you want things to go and then are like, oh no, are the players going to go that way?
It can be very tempting to sort of get attached to those outcomes. I know with 183 Days, that was like definitely something that we struggled with, you know, because since it's inspired by this novella, which ends a certain way, there was a question of like, well, okay, do we want to try to make sure that the game ends the same way for everybody or for most people? And I ended up being, we decided to leave it a little more open-ended. And we definitely felt like it was down to like changing a couple sentences on like a couple cards that we felt would make like a really big difference from when we did like small little play tests of those things. And I think that as much as you can let go of the idea that your game should have a specific outcome, I think that that's usually better. It really depends on the game, though. I mean, with See Me Now, that was another game where we were pretty concerned about sort of like what direction it might go in. You know, the game deals with gender and it deals with sexuality. It deals with queer issues and trans issues. But my own experience of being a queer human being is like that while, you know, there's a lot of darkness and negativity and like awful stuff going on in the world, especially a lot of like awful oppressive stuff being directed at trans people right now, there's still a lot of strength and positivity that can be gained through community. And we wanted to make sure that someone who might not have those life experiences, that if they approach the game, they wouldn't only kind of go toward the negative. Because I think that while I'm really happy that there's this like level of awareness of those issues, I don't want it to be like, oh, now we're going to play this like real, real sad story about a bunch of queer folks. So that was something where we made some choices, you know, specifically trying to build up those more positive elements to make sure that there was enough balance there, that it wasn't like just this like super tragic story.
Oh, I think that's super, super important. And like for queer people to be able to engage with queer media that isn't just like, you're going to get bashed and die. Like, you know, to just be like, oh, there are other possibilities.
Yeah. And then you get kicked out of your parents' house. And then, you know, and it's like, well, yes, those things really happen. And like those are important. But like, there's so much goodness there, too.
Yeah. And like, I think very, very often you can get caught in this trap of like making a queer story for straight people, which is like you have to remind them that like it can be really hard. But mm-hmm. you again, you have to remind yourself that, like, also other queer people are engaging with this, and it might be really helpful and, like, positive and, like, open up new things to say, like, also it can be, like, this amazing, wonderful, like, open aspect of your life that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that at some point, and I might actually, like, try to shoehorn this theme into my insect, like, embodiment game, which is a game that kind of represents relationships in poly configurations. I think that there's this really interesting thing. There's a bit of polyamory jargon called metamour, which is when your partner has another partner. And so it's like, oh, this is my girlfriend, and my girlfriend's husband is my metamour. Mm-hmm. And that's such an alien relationship to so many people. And it's also, it can be, like, such a real positive, like, wonderful thing. Like, I've had really intensely good friendships with metamours. And sometimes when I try to describe this sort of thing, they're like, wait, but isn't there jealousy? And I'm like, well, yeah, sometimes. And then you process it. But then, like, after you're done processing it, then there are, like, periods where it's, like, really, really wonderful. And, like, it's different for different people, of course. But, like, the idea that, like, most people that I know have no idea how positive a relationship that can be. And, like, to them, it's, like, not even a concept that exists in their minds. Like, I would love to, like, bring that concept to other people. I feel like that's probably, like, the number one thing about polyamory that I think is, like, a big benefit that hasn't, like, gained any sort of mainstream awareness.
Yeah.
Like, all of the, like, articles and mainstream stuff about poly are just about, like, some dude with two girlfriends, right? Yeah. Like, it's pretty heteronormative.
Mm-hmm.
And something that can, like, represent that facet of queerness to a wider audience is definitely something I'm interested in, something that I think a game could do really well. There are actually, like, a lot of games that deal with poly or sort of, like, open relationships, but a lot of them focus on the drama aspects. Yeah. And I think something that kind of focuses on the benefits or, like, just the actual logistics of, like, what it's like in your day-to-day life to manage
yeah.
a poly relationship. Like, that's, I think, something that I want to design for, too.
Yeah. As someone who has, like, the best metamour ever, like, I really, really feel that as an idea. I would really, really like to, I don't know, be able to just, like, talk about that relationship as, like, the positive and cool and special thing that it is, and, like, not all the things that people assume it must be or that God knows it could be, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah, like, I want to have a game where it's like, oh, and now I'm out with my metamour and we're both shopping for presents for our mutual partner because we both, like, yeah. have this understanding of what they like. Like, I think that's something that a lot of people who haven't been in those sort of relationships, like, wouldn't necessarily imagine, but it's, like, part of so many people's lives. And I think that's, like, something unique to games is just the way that you can really, like, transport someone into a different experience.
Yeah, it's a powerful way to share that. Last thing I want to ask you about, you contributed to Jason Morningstar's most recent game, The Skeletons.
I did.
You have, like, an alternate setting.
Yeah.
Packaged in with that. What was that like as a designer to kind of play in someone else's playground?
Oh, it was fantastic. So that came out of me getting to playtest The Skeletons when Jason ran it at Dreamation, and I got to play the type of skeleton that's essentially, like, a monstrous creature that's been assembled by a wizard, and, like, the picture on the character sheet, and you get to draw on your character sheets, which I love. I've always been, like, the person doodling on their character sheet the entire time when I'm playing, like, a tabletop game. And so this particular skeleton has, like, the body of a sloth and then, like, the skull of a corvid bird, like, just this big, like, long beak and all of this, like, glorious stuff. And so I was just, like, so, so deeply into this game and into my skeleton. And so Jason and I were chatting about it afterwards, and he asked me to contribute. And so what I wrote are an alternate set of invaders for the tomb. So Jason just made this, like, really wonderful framework of, you are these skeletons, you're inhabiting this tomb, you've been cursed to defend it, and different invaders come in and challenge your tomb and try to desecrate it, and you have to beat them back. And in doing so, your skeletons unearth and, like, dislodge memories of their past lives. And so the invaders are such a really great opportunity to inject a theme into the story that you're telling and to sort of influence the memories that the skeletons might be recovering. So I wrote a theme which is kind of like a war story in a way, where there are wounded soldiers sort of like fleeing from the war coming in and different armies. And so you can sort of tell this story of like a war-torn land, because that was something that really resonated with me. I guess apart from Shelter, it's the only game that I've written that or contributed to that has like kind of a classic like gamey fantasy sort of flavor to it. And so it was nice to go back to that and play in that setting that Jason made.
Yeah, well, there's a reason so many people play in that sandbox. It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a fun one.
Yeah, and it's also, like, deeply connected to, like, my childhood and a lot of other people that play games, you know, childhoods. Like, it's a fun thing to go back to.
Yeah, well, and Shelter's a great example that you can play in that fiction and use those tropes and still have it be about actual, you know, like, Shelter's a sort of sword and sandal thing, kind of, or sorry, sword and sorcery, but also, like, the story of a relationship and the story of being in love and missing someone. So like those two can go hand in hand, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember like reading a bunch of Forgotten Realms books as a kid and like Lord of the Rings too, and just being like, why isn't there more romance? That's clearly the best part. Like whenever there was like a tiny glimpse of it, I was like, yeah, that's like way what I'm into. But I didn't want to pick up like a romance book with mundane people in it. Like clearly there needed
boring.
To be, there needed to be magic and elves too. Like otherwise what was the point? But like having stories about relationships like in those kind of fantastical settings is like a fond thing for me.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I feel like we should probably wrap things up. Where can my listeners find more of your cool thoughts and words and games?
They should definitely find me at Google+. They should look for Sarah Williamson. And on Twitter, my handle is I am the only Sarah, because I'm clearly not. All the other Sarah handles were taken.
And which this show alone has proved very incorrect. Yeah. I'm kind of Sarah Binge lately, I don't know if you noticed.
And 183 Days is available on DriveThruCards under our publishing name Tiny Knives. And See Me Now is going to be out pretty soon, I think. So I'm a little bit scattered all over the internet right now, but those are all of the different sources where people can find my stuff.
Nice. Well, I'll put links to all that stuff in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was really great.
Well, thanks again to Sarah for chatting with me and to you for listening. I'll have links to Sarah's projects and many of the things we talked about in today's episode in the show notes. Heroes, remember that I love hearing your thoughts on the show. You can always reach me via email, backstorypodcast@gmail.com, on Google+, Backstory Podcast, or on Twitter at BackstoryCast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, and Talking Tabletop. Music is provided by Ujiko, and the track is called Thinking of You. You can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes.